Omagarvanandasya gananjana salakaya taksur unvalitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadam hayam didati swapadantikam vandeham shri guru shri yuta parakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tham Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Vrijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shivasakam Vitamscha हे कृष्णा कर्णसिंधु दीनबंधु जगतपते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानु सुत देवी प्राणमामि हरि प्रिये पंचकाप ध्रुव्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभ्यश्च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudevi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jai Nityananda Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jai Nityananda Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
On Sunday we read from a book called the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. But the verses aren't on board, so I'll just read the text, the center of the Bengali, and the translation of the purport. This is called Madhya Leela, Chapter 8, Talks Between the Lord and Ramananda Roy, text number 312. Damodars Rupena Kadachan Anusare Ramananda Milana Lila Karila Prachare. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. I have tried to preach the pastimes of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu meeting with Ramananda Roy in accordance with the notebooks of Sri Srupadamodar. Explanation. At the end of every chapter, the author admits the value of the disciple succession. He never claims to have written this transcendental literature by carrying out research work. He simply admits his indebtedness to the notes taken by Srupadamodar, Raghunath Das Goswami, and other authoritative persons. This is the way of describing transcendental literatures, which are never meant for so-called scholars and research workers. The process is mahadno yena katha sapanda. One has to strictly follow the great personalities and acharyas. Acharyavan purusho veda. One who has the favor of the acharyas knows everything. Sometimes the prakrita sahajiyas claim that they have heard the truth from their guru. However, one cannot have transcendental knowledge simply by hearing from a guru who is not bona fide. The guru must be bona fide, and he must have heard from his bona fide guru. Only then will his message be accepted as bona fide. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Bhagavan Uvachi Mam Vishvate Yogam Proktavana Hamaviyam Vivishvan Manave Praha Mano Ikshvakave Bravit. The Blessed Lord said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivashvan, and Vivashvan instructed to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed to Ikshvaku. In this way, the message is transmitted in the bona fide disciple succession from the bona fide spiritual master to bona fide student. Srila Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, therefore, as usual, includes this chapter by reasserting his faith in the lotus feet of the six Goswamis. Thus he is able to set forth his transcendental literature, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sri Rupa Raghunatha Pade Ara Asha Yara Asha Chaitanya Charitamrita Kahe Krishna Dasa. Praying at the lotus feet of Sri Rupa and Sri Raghunath, those desiring their mercy, I, Krishna Das, narrate Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita following their footsteps. Mahal Vishnu Vidaya Krishna Pristai Vidaya Srimati Bhakti Vidaya Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasatam Deve Gauravani Kucharne Nirvishesha Srinivadi Pastakya De Satarne. Here is an explanation of our science called Krishna Consciousness. Krishna consciousness is principally a spiritual science, although other aspects of life were also included. But the method of understanding this science is different from other modern so-called sciences. The Vedic literature explains that there are 10 principal methods of understanding, or proof. Proof means we want something practical to happen. Just like, for instance, if we drink water, we expect that, practically speaking, our quench will be thirst, or we'll be satisfied. If we drink water and we're becoming more and more thirsty, then that's not a very good sign that water is actually water, or only water, or that we're in a healthy condition. Practically speaking, we want that there should be something called cause and effect, that a certain cause should produce a certain effect. And basically speaking, the effect that we want, ultimately, is we want happiness, pleasure. Therefore, we want to find out what is the cause of pleasure. That's called knowledge. If we discover something that puts us and everyone else into misery, that's not very intelligent. Modern society, they've discovered many things that are called knowledge, but the effect ultimately is not happiness, is not pleasure, it's suffering. Although temporarily it may give something which is like pleasure or happiness, But the ultimate effect is not satisfying. Or it may be satisfying to some people, but it's not satisfying to everyone. Just like certain countries may be proud they have an atomic weapon, and they can explode it over everyone's head. So that may make some people happy, but obviously it's not going to make everyone happy. Real knowledge, or real, as it explains, real benefit is something that's beneficial for everyone, all auspicious. That gives everyone happiness, that gives good qualities. This is called auspiciousness. And the Vedic literature is aimed principally at auspiciousness, just as every other literature is claiming, at least, that the objective is to avoid material miseries and attain happiness. The principal book is the Bhagavad Gita, and Bhagavad Gita is being spoken by Lord Krishna 5,000 years ago, and in Bhagavad Gita, the principal assertion is that Krishna is God, and that what Krishna is saying is universal. It's true for everyone, for all time. That's the definition of God. God means someone who knows everything, both in the past and the present and the future. Therefore, he can give us information which is steady or applicable in any place, at any time, under any circumstances. The essence. And the first thing that Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, I have to say that it is not that one has to accept that Krishna is God blindly. That would not be very intelligent. And Bhagavad Gita Prabhupada writes that blind following and absurd inquiries are condemned, that one should not only hear submissively, but one should get a clear understanding through submission, service, and inquiry. The aim of the Bhagavad Gita is not to develop some fanatical faith that Krishna is God, and therefore I'm actually should be a Hare Krishna. And the way I show that I'm a Hare Krishna, that I show that my faith is that my hair falls out and I put on bed sheets. Then I've accepted Bhagavad Gita as it actually is. Now the idea of hearing the Bhagavad Gita is to get a clear understanding. Whether whatever our dress happens to be, wherever our address happens to be, that's not the important thing. The important thing is that we see things clearly. Seeing things clearly means I know how to act in such a way that I become perpetually happy. And that wherever I am, whoever I am, whatever I'm doing, I know the essence of that activity in such a way that I can perform it in such a way is it gives me happiness. And we can understand and appreciate that Krishna is God if we read his book and it has absolute knowledge. That we have to judge for ourselves. We have to see for ourselves whether it works. The scientists, the modern scientists, are given credit because they're able to perform some practical activities. They're able to make computers and airplanes and other such technological advancement. They say that if you press this button, then something will come out. Whatever will come out, whether it's a toy airplane or whatever else. So we appreciate that they've understood to a certain extent what the cause and effects are. Because they haven't made that much advancement beyond the birds. For instance, the birds can fly in the sky, and we can also fly in the sky. So we've come up to at least the level of achievement of the birds. Or other such animals. We can dig into these. We can have subways. Just like there are many animals, they dig tunnels, like ants, insects, they dig tunnels. So we've come at least to that level of technological of achievement. Maybe we can explode a bomb and kill hundreds and thousands of people, and the primitive people, they would take a club and hit one or two people over the head at a time with it. So we've made some technology. If that's advancement, then we've made that as advancement. But Bhagavad Gita, we can examine and see whether or not it produces happiness. And the first thing Krishna begins with instructing, because Arjuna was quite disturbed for many different reasons, which we don't have to go over, but he was disturbed just like we may become disturbed in this present time because we're not satisfied. Neither we're happy about our own condition, nor are we happy about other people's conditions. Anyone who thinks that everyone in this material world is happy, that means either they don't read newspapers, or they're happy to find out that other people are unhappy. But Bhagavad Gita begins, which we can examine with our intelligence, because that's how everything is ultimately judged. We judge ourselves whether it makes sense to us, whether we think that by following this advice, this practical advice, then I'll become happy. That's what we call intelligence. Because in modern society, people are thinking that happiness means sense gratification. That is, if I can fulfill the demands, the dictation of my mind and senses, then I'll become happy. One man was asking another person, if you're intelligent. So the man immediately checked his pocket to find out if he had any money in it. The idea was that if he had money, then he must be intelligent. Otherwise, how do you get money? Bhagavad Gita has a different viewpoint on this particular subject matter. Krishna begins talking to Arjuna not as a Hindu god. Some people may think that Krishna is speaking as a Hindu god to Arjuna because he was a Hindu. But 5,000 years ago, there were no Hindus. Nor were there any Hindu gods because Krishna was not known as a Hindu god. And therefore Krishna did not turn to Arjuna and say, my dear Arjuna, please listen because you're a Hindu and it's hard to find Hindus around here, especially for Hindu gods. So I'll tell you all about the Hindus. So you're the only one who's around who's a Hindu. And he begins with, Dehnosmi nita dehe kamaram yovanam jara tatadahantara praptira dhiryas tatra namuyati. Krishna's initial instruction in Bhagavad Gita is very practical. He says that, Arjuna, your body is changing. And most of us, if we're honest, if we examine our life so far, we'll find out that our body has also changed. So it is not that this instruction was only meant for Arjuna, but it's meant for every living entity, because every living entity, not only the human form of life, but in other forms of life also, everyone's body is changing. And generally people go from boyhood to youth, or girlhood to youth, to old age. And then there's something called death, which we're not supposed to talk about. But I guess we can, because this is the reincarnation weekend. The general sequence is birth, growing, then you become older, God forbid, and then we die. Oh, that sounds horrible. But that's the way things work. Although modern society is dedicated to trying to help people forget that that's how things work. But that is how actually things work, that people's bodies change and they don't become younger. Although we'd like them to become younger, we like to think we're becoming younger, but the fact is we don't. And the final change is called death. But as Krishna told Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, that there's a person inside the body who is not changing. So that person is not very mysterious who that person is. It happens to be ourselves. It's not our minds. It's not our spirit. Sometimes you say, my spirit's not changing. As if we have a spirit. But who is the person who has a spirit? It's us. We are the spirit. But now we're misidentifying ourselves with the body, Therefore, as the body changes, we think that we're changing. Although, a little thought with a little thoughtfulness, we'll find out that we haven't changed. Only our body has changed. And then people say, well, my mind has changed. But neither we are the mind. We have so many feelings that this is good and this is bad. And that also changes, but we're the person who had those good and bad feelings. Today I may like strawberry, and yesterday I liked vanilla. But I'm the person who likes strawberry vanilla. And we may say my personality has changed. Hopefully it's changed since we've been 3 years old. So certainly there's been change of personality, but our personality is just our perspective on life, the way we see things. As our intelligence increases, then our personality changes. As our perspective on life changes, then our personality changes. So that constant change of intelligence means that we're the person who has intelligence or is using intelligence. Just like a father instructs a son or a teacher instructs a student, so we're the person who is receiving intelligence from higher authority and utilizing it, trying to find out how to become happy. But we're the same person who had the 5-year-old intelligence. We're the same person who has this present intelligence. And in the future, if we receive more or less intelligence, we'll be the same person receiving that intelligence. So we're not the personality either. We're the person who's aware of the present body, who's aware of the present mind, the present conception of life. And whatever our body, mind, or conception of life is, we'll always remain that same person. But certain bodies, certain minds, feelings, thoughts, certain personalities or conceptions of life will make us happier, and some will make us unhappier. So that's up to us, ultimately, according to Bhagavad Gita. That's the whole purpose of Bhagavad Gita. So we can choose what is the best body, what is the best conception of life, what is the best mental thought, so that we can get the maximum amount of happiness. So here it says, it is not that we have to make it up. It is not that the laws of material nature change according to our particular vision of the laws. Just like I may believe or I may not believe that my body is changing. Often we can explain to people on the street, ordinary people, that your body is changing. And they can reluctantly accept that. And then when you mention to them that you yourself with the body are not changing, they become very bewildered. They feel almost insulted. That how dare you say that I'm not changing. I am the body. I am the mind. Or I am the intelligence. Or if I am the soul, then they can't really understand what the soul is, who they are. But whether or not we believe in the existence of the soul, for instance, many people don't believe that they're going to die. That's ahani, ahani, bhutani, gacchanti, amalaya. The most amazing thing is that somehow or another we think that although so many other people have died, still somehow or another I'm going to stay here. I'm going to be immune. But the fact is, a little thoughtfulness, we can see that even for one moment, we can't stop the body from changing. We may try and forget that my body's changing, or pretend that I'm exactly the same I was yesterday. But at every moment, step by step, our body is continuously changing, and the final change is always death. We cannot avoid the laws of nature. We may not understand what they are. We may speculate what they are. We deny their existence. But the practical law of nature is that my body must change and that the final change is called death. So that much I have to recognize. Now, if I'm a spiritual soul, if I've come to at least that much understanding, there are different ways of coming to understanding. As I mentioned, there are 10 different types of pramanas of proof. 3 principal proofs are pratyaksha, anuman, and shabda. So pratyaksha means what we can observe. Modern science is principally concerned with what we can observe, because they don't believe or they won't accept that there's any higher way of observing, of experiencing things. They don't think that anyone was more intelligent than they are. No one had a more clear vision of reality than they do. Everyone else was speculating except for them. They don't believe there's such a thing as ancient sages. They think the sages were in ignorance. After all, if they're intelligent, if they're intelligent, why didn't they have computers? Why didn't they have television? Why didn't they have the internet? Why were they walking around in bare feet? Why were they living in huts? That's what they think, that was not very intelligent. Why were they spending all their time chanting? Why didn't they, have rock music? Because their basic principle is that advancement means technological advancement for sense gratification. The basic principle of modern society is that we are the body, and advancement means the ability to gratify the senses at any time, in any place, under any circumstances. The more we can eat, sleep, have sex, and defend ourselves spontaneously, without any aversion, without any hesitation, under any circumstance, in any place, with anyone or anything, that's advancement. Therefore, when they see that people are not, we're not eating, sleeping, mating, defending in the same luxurious way that modern society is trying to do it, they think they were just not very intelligent. But the whole modern philosophy of the purpose of life being to arrange our lives in such a way that we can eat anything from anywhere. That why just eat the same ordinary food you can get in Belgium when you can have it shipped in from South America, instead of eating food in the winter that's prepared, that's available here, you can have bananas blown in from South America. So you can imagine you're in a tropical climate in Belgium in the winter. Because, unfortunately, they can't fly in ripe bananas. They have to fly in unripe bananas. So the only real, it looks like a banana, has the same color as a banana. We never know what a real banana tastes like, so whatever it is, it must be what a banana is. At least it's like what a banana is in Belgium in the winter. But we take happiness. I'm eating a banana. I'm controlling part of South America. Part of South America is surrendered to me and is offering Gundabots on my plate right now. So not only controlling this little bit of Belgium, but also part of South America is surrendered to me. Pragyaksha means that we take things, our sensory perception as everything. According to the Vedas, the difficulty of accepting the senses as everything is that our senses are imperfect. They have certain defects. One of them is they're imperfect. If a dog whistle is blown, then we cannot hear it. Only the dogs can hear it. If there is a certain spectrum of light that the bats can see, we can't see it. Therefore, we can't fly at night. We can't fly during the daytime either. And we have, that's the first defect, it's imperfect senses. The second is that we're committing mistakes. That's why they put an eraser at the end of pencil, when people used to have pencils. But now they just have a backspace on the computer, because people don't know how to use pencils anymore. The eraser is too technical for most people to use nowadays, so they just have a backspace. And they can't do that anymore, so they have to have it by dictation. Have to have a program. Erase. Because they know as soon as we type something, it's probably going to be wrong. So most people, they write, if they're writing a book, they'll write the book, and they'll spend most of the time trying to correct whatever they wrote. Because we commit mistakes. And we're an illusion. The fact is that we're not the body, for instance. but were an illusion to identify ourselves with the body. And in spite of the fact we have imperfect senses, we're committing mistakes, and we're subject to illusion, still we put forward our knowledge as perfect. Otherwise, they wouldn't have universities. Why would people go to learn something that was wrong? Would you spend $20,000 a year to learn something that was wrong? But if you go to the universities nowadays and you learn the science of physics, you'll find out that everything they taught you 20 years ago was wrong. And if you go 20 years from now, you'll probably find out that most, if not everything, what they teach you nowadays is also wrong. But still they're putting forward as science, as the truth. So this is called cheating. But, in other words, pratyaksha has its difficulty. Although senses are not negated, what we're saying is not absolutely wrong, but there may be some element of its being imperfect, imperfect perception. And on the basis of pratyaksha, or our experience, our sensory perception, we put forward logical hypotheses, which may be defective due to the fact that our senses are imperfect. For instance, we can see the sun in the sky, and to our senses it appears to be a little ball of fire. Relatively little ball of fire. But hearing from authorities, or from persons who have extended their senses and used their logic and reason, they ascertain that the sun is actually millions or thousands of times bigger than the earth planet. That we cannot judge the size of the sun simply with our sensory perception. Therefore, we have to trust logic and reasoning, deduction. But because it's based upon imperfect senses, therefore it's also defective. There's another type of evidence which is called shabda, or hearing from authority. Of course, to a certain extent, we accept authority, just like we accept the scientists. They've looked out through the telescope, and by their mathematical calculations, they've ascertained that the sun is actually so much bigger than we perceive it to be. And most of what the scientists tell us, we have to accept on the basis of their authority, because we have no way of even seeing what they're talking about. If they talk about what the atom looks like, who has seen an atom with their own eyes? Because the scientists haven't seen an atom with their own eyes either. An example can be used that a scientist can take a little particle and slam it into another particle, and from out of that particle comes something. They can say, well, that's what the particle is made of. But that's just an assumption. They take a cyclotron and they throw one little particle at a super fast speed into another particle, and something comes out and they say that's what the particle is made of. That's what the atom is made of. But that's just an assumption. For instance, if we take a dog and we hit the dog, then out of the dog will come woofs. Woof, woof. We've seen that around here all the time. Even without hitting the dog, out of the dog comes woofs. But we don't assume that the dog is made out of woofs. So we can't really say that by our imperfect methodology we've actually understood things correctly. But to a certain extent, we assume it's correct if they make experiments and it works. In other words, they get some more confidence that their assumptions are true because it works in a practical way in this material world. Of course, nowadays we find out that by finding out that the laws of gravity are contradicted by the laws of other laws, that they have... What is the new laws, physical laws called? Quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics have different laws than the laws of Newtonian physics. Therefore, it's quite a grab bag. You can believe practically by science, you can believe in practically anything. Multi-dimensional worlds, where we're living in so many worlds we don't even know about. And the past, present, future, they're all happening simultaneously. Everything's going to a curve or bending or crisscrossing. Whatever, you can believe practically anything by science. But shabda means we hear, and then by that hearing, we can, with our intelligence, ascertain by our own experience the truth of it, whether it's true or not, whether it makes sense. And that knowledge is coming through higher authority. Persons who have already taken to the path and they have heard, ultimately we say from Krishna. Our assumption is that Krishna is God, that there is a God, and because He is God, He knows everything. And if we hear from Him, then we'll be able to see whether or not He's saying is true enough. We don't have to discover the truth. If the truth is already present before us, if we hear it, then we'll see it. And the first truth, Krishna says, is that the body's changing, but we're not changing. Even a 3-year-old child can understand that, but a 50-year-old professor may have a hard time understanding. Not because the knowledge is difficult, because it's too simple. Because it's too clear, and material conditioned life, we understand, is a place where we've come to make everything confusing. The reality is what we've rejected by coming here, and therefore when we hear reality, it seems very confusing. And when we hear things that have no sense whatsoever, or nonsense, it starts to a person who is nonsense, it makes some sense. Therefore, the whole process is hearing, beginning with hearing, that the body is changing, but we ourselves are not changing. Just like I've mentioned before, sometimes when I'm distributing books on the street, I'll ask people, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body? After all, many times it's scientifically educated people who've gone to university, some of them have PhD degrees and professors, and we ask them this question. What's the difference between a living body and a dead body? Because it's not exactly an irrelevant question for most people, since soon they'll have a dead body. So it's good to know what the difference is between when the body's alive and dead, so you can know what to do with it. And most of them say, even the big professors, they say the difference between a living body and a dead body, they've concluded by their astute observations, is that a living body is alive and a dead body is dead. And then I'll say, no, you don't. What we're asking is, what is the difference? And then most of them who are honest will admit they don't know what the difference is. I usually give the example is that when you have a car, as long as there's a driver in the car, then the car moves. And as soon as the driver leaves the body, then the car can't move anymore. So similarly, as long as the soul is in the body moves. And as soon as the soul leaves the body doesn't move anymore. So that's the difference. And so far, somehow or another, maybe we lose reenergy, bewilder people, but I've never had anyone disagree with it. No, that's not true, you know, you don't need a driver for a car. Cars just kind of go along by themselves, by accident. Cars have their own accidents. The cause of the accident was not the person, it was the car. Take the car to court. Sue the car. That's the beginning. And then there may be so much other instructions. I was going to a little verse here, which I don't think I read them. Then the Bhagavad Gita, the question is, why is that the soul, ourselves, everyone loves, we all love ourselves, this dear soul, myself, who I'm trying to get everyone else to love, but to speak of myself. I'm so much in love with myself, I think everyone else should love myself. And this body, even if it's not me, people should love it because it has some relationship with the dearmost object in this world, me. Even if I wasn't the body, it wouldn't make any difference, but because the body has some relation to me, therefore it should be appreciated. So the question is, why this little soul, or big soul, however you want to think of yourself, why is it that this soul isn't a body? Of course, in modern society, people glorify the body as it's, you know, of course, it's a gift of God, this body. Of course, then we have to think that birth, old age, disease, and death are just wonderful experiences that everyone looks forward to. And that the miseries that people are going through is just part of the happiness. But we can, by objective reasoning, most people can see that they're trying to obtain happiness. It's not that we're overwhelmed with happiness all the time. If you go downtown Brussels, you won't find that most people are just dancing in the street. Oh, I'm so happy, it's such a wonderful day out. Everyone's so kind around here, and I'm just so satisfied because all my desires are fulfilled even without having to work hard. Such a wonderful existence here. We don't find that experience. So people are trying to become happy, that means they're not happy. And if you don't have to work hard and suffer to become happy, that may not be the best way of ultimate happiness. That the more I suffer, the more I work hard and suffer here, then the happier I become. Or I will become. Different Bhagavad Gita Krishna explains the reason why we're an illusion is ultimately because we want to be an illusion. We want to think ourselves to be someone that we're not. So which exactly person we want to think ourselves? Well, we can see that there are many opportunities to be different persons. Just like in this reincarnation weekend, we found out, or some of us found out, that we may have been, or we were, different persons. Different bodies, we had different bodies. Just like every year they come out with a new car. And as soon as people get a new car, they start identifying themselves with the car. Now, last year I was a 2003 Ford, and this year I'm a 2004 Ford. I've grown up. So this is called, in Sanskrit, there's a technical word for it, ahamkar. I am the car. And we think that as we change our car, that we're actually changing. But actually, it's the same person simply getting a different car. We haven't become a new car. We're simply the same old soul in a new car. We don't drink wine, so we don't say same old wine in a new bottle. We say same old soul in a new car. That's our... And it doesn't matter which particular car we have, we're going to be the same soul. Now the question is, why is the soul taking different bodies? Because in Bhagavad Gita it explains the soul wants to imitate God. And if the soul didn't have a material body, it couldn't think that it was imitating God. Because this body seems to be lording it over or controlling different aspects of material nature. And because we think we are the body, therefore we think that we're the ones who are controlling or enjoying material nature. And we're trying to do it in different bodies. And everyone's trying to do it in different bodies. We do get different opportunities to think like that. If we have the body of a pig, we're also thinking we're controlling material nature, but our realm of experience is limited, a little bit more limited to a pig's sty. And if we have a human form of life, we may have vast amounts of land that we think we're the owner of. Although when we go to sleep at night, we only can control around 6 feet if we're 6 feet tall. But still we're thinking we're controlling everything. And we can lord it over principally by eating. As I mentioned, we may not be able to control anything else in this world. Our mother, our wife or our husband may not listen to us. Our children may be rebellious. Even our dog may even snap at us sometimes. No one may be submissive, But when the carrot is on our plate offering dandavats, then we know it's surrendered to us. And by its surrender, by assimilating, by surrendering itself, becoming one with me through the process of entering, surrendering into my stomach, being thrown into the fire of the sacrifice in the stomach, and becoming one with me, then it'll empower me. So in the future, so many other carrots and potatoes and whatever else is there will also surrender into me. So we get some sense of satisfaction through the process of eating, that no one likes me, everyone hates me, but I'm going to eat a carrot. At least I get that much satisfaction that I'm still in control of it. This idea that I am the Lord, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer, this is the basic principle. And Bhagavad Gita will explain that above the laws of nature is time, the time factor which is controlling everything, and that time works under the control of a person. Just like everything else in this world that we have experience with acts under the control of a person. Now there are things within this world we have no direct experience of the person controlling them, but we can conclude that because we can't see the person, therefore there's no person controlling these things. For instance, often we may walk into a factory and see that the factory is going on. We may not see the person pulling the switches in the factory, but we assume that because the factory is nicely constructed, it's logically arranged, it's producing some results that are consistent, therefore we assume that there must be a person controlling, persons controlling within the factory. Similarly, the whole universe, for instance, is just like a big watch. How do we know it's like a big watch? Because these little watches that we have, they're made by scientists in order to try to emulate or duplicate the precision of the big clock. For instance, the sun, it rises at a certain time, the sun sets at a certain time, and on the basis of that they make clocks. Even atomic clocks are not so precise as the sun is. The universe can be taken as a big clock. Now if we take someone, we see a little watch, and someone asks, who made that watch? It looks very nice. And we say, well, that watch came about by accident. Even though it has some label on it, like Rolex. It said it had Rolex. Well, it was just an accident. It was an expensive accident. But people won't accept that. It says Rolex on it. It's working so nicely. Then how can you say it's an accident? You're just kidding me. But if we take a bigger watch, say a clock, time bend in England, and they say, well, here's a bigger clock. And you say, how did that come about? Well, it's an accident. It's bigger, right? Bigger things come about by bigger accidents. Now you think, well, it must have taken more intelligent person to, you know, more effort, more intelligence to put together a bigger clock, especially if it works nicer. And then you find out the universe is the biggest clock, and you say, well, it must be the biggest accident, right? Logically follow. We've concluded that the little watch wasn't by accident, the bigger clock wasn't by accident, and therefore the biggest clock must definitely be by accident. No, an intelligent person will understand that if it's more precise and bigger, it means more intelligence, more power to put it together. And that's a more powerful person. There's always a person behind the clock, behind the watch, and how can there not be a person behind the universe that's put it together? Now that person says that he's God, because that he wasn't voted into Godhood. Therefore, people think that he's not really God because no one gave him, or I didn't give him my vote. So how could he really be God? Because this is the age of democracy. People don't get a position unless they're voted into it. Most of the Bhagavad Gita's that we're going to read, they don't say that Krishna is God. They think that Krishna is a nice person, very intelligent, may have been more powerful than we are. He only made one mistake. Not exactly a mistake, but he was saying the same thing that everyone is, that he was God. He was in the same consciousness that everyone is. Just normally, I think I'm God. And he thought he was God too, because everyone thinks they're God. Isn't that the philosophy? So Krishna said in Bhagavad Gita that he was God. It's just natural. He's under the same consciousness, the same understanding that everyone is. So Krishna is God, and I'm God. We're all God. That's true. Unfortunately, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he's God and no one else is God. So people think, well, Krishna must, he was a little egotistical. He was trying to make monopoly on Godhead. Therefore, he had one slight mistake in Bhagavad Gita. Or, when he said he was God, he didn't really mean himself. He was referring to someone else. They say someone else within Krishna is God, and Krishna is just pointing that out, whoever that is. Now the question is, that if Krishna made a mistake in the Bhagavad Gita, then why does everyone write commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita? Because if the Bhagavad Gita is imperfect, then why are people trying to analyze what Krishna said? There are many books that are written, but they don't have 700-800 scholars analyzing it. Just like, for instance, they came out with some book, The Lord of the Rings. Well, although it's a very popular movie, but there's no scholar analyzing it. At least not 700 scholars trying to analyze the meaning of what it's saying. Bhagavad Gita must be a special book, otherwise so many persons wouldn't try to interpret it. But unfortunately, most of them say that Krishna was wrong. Now, if he was wrong, why are they wasting their time with it? So either Krishna is wrong, and he's not God, or they're wrong. And if they're wrong, or Krishna is wrong, then their commentaries are all useless, because then they're writing commentaries in a useless book. And anyone who reads a useless commentary is also wasting their time. They're also useless. Therefore, to assume that Krishna is wrong from the beginning, that he's not God, then one is simply wasting their time reading a useless, making useless speculations on a book that they think is useless. So the fact is that at least theoretically we have to begin with that Krishna is God, and that means that we're not God. Because if Krishna is God, we've just lost the contest. Although we're always losing the contest anyhow. If we just look at our lives, now we're always controlled. We're always controlled by the material nature. Otherwise, why are we taking so many different bodies? Why don't we just stay in this body? Belgium may have some problems, but it's not so bad to be in Belgium. After all, I may leave this body, and I may come back in a body that I didn't want. So why can't we control at least this one little body we have? At least we can't control Afghanistan or Iraq or America. Why can't I, or who becomes the president of Belgium or the prime minister? But why can't I at least control this one body I have so it stops changing for a few moments? One moment, let me stop it. In other words, I'm not in control at all. I have to at least understand that at least material nature is controlling me. And above material nature is time, which is changing everything in material nature. And if time is working according to certain laws called karma, there's a person above time. From my own experience, I can understand that there is a God. Whoever their God is, whoever that person is controlling everything. Then I should find out what is my relationship with that person, because after all, if he can control the changing of the body, maybe he can give me an opportunity to stop changing bodies. That's at least a possibility. So without getting into all the details, because I'll just mention briefly, that in the Bhagavad Gita it mentions that there are five anchors that keep us in this bodily concept of life. One anchor is our attachment to this body, to the bodily concept of life. Some people think that they're actually going to enjoy life in this body, and therefore they like being in a body. They wouldn't give up their body for anything. As I mentioned before, Srila Prabhupada was giving a lecture at one university, and he was explaining about transmigration to soul. And he mentioned that if you act like a dog, you may become a dog. And one student raised her hand and said, Swamiji, you say that if I act like a dog, then I'll become a dog. But I want you to know that I don't mind if I become a dog, As a matter of fact, I want to become a dog. I really want to be a dog. The Prabhupada raised his hand and said, you have my blessing. But people are attached to the bodily concept of life, then it's not possible to get out of it. The next stage is that one may be attached to the land of birth. People may give up many things, but very rarely do they give up their attachment to the place where they were born. They always identify it. That I'm not an ordinary Hare Krishna, I'm a New York Hare Krishna. And then that's the second stage. The next stage is that one may become attached to one's material possessions. The house, the wealth, the family, whatever else, one may identify oneself with that. The bodily relationships. Well, actually the second thing is bodily relationships, the land of birth, then bodily relationships, and one's particular possessions and wealth. So there's another state of attachment. And the next state of attachment is attachment to science. That is always mysterious because it's not based upon spiritual knowledge. Therefore it's always changing and very mysterious. And the last state of attachment is attachment to the rituals, the holy rituals, certain religious procedures, without understanding either God or the devotees behind them, which make the rituals holy. So these attachments bind us to the material world. Now the question is how we get out of these attachments, out of this binding. So Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he gives a whole sequence, Nirmana Moha Jita Sangha Dosha Adhyatma Nityavya Nivritta Kama Dvandvaiva Mukha Dukha Sukha Dham Sangar Kachatni Buddha Padam Avyamta. That those who are free from false prestige. So we're very proud of being something that we're not. Just like we went back in regression and found out that I was Napoleon. I wasn't Napoleon. But say we found out that I was Napoleon, then I'd be very proud. That I would be walking around. Do you know who I was in my last lifetime? I was Napoleon. Because most people wouldn't be very impressed. But still, I'd be impressed. I'd be proud. Or I may be proud that I was born, for instance, I was born in Belgium. So people may be very proud. Everyone has some reason to be proud that we're very, you know, Americans are very boisterous and loud. They have this propensity to try and lord it over and control people. They disturb people, but we Belgian people, we don't disturb anyone. We don't even disturb each other. We're very mild and we're gentlemen and ladies here. But there's always some reason to be proud wherever we're born. So this pride in one's material circumstances, either past, present, and future, binds us to this false conception of identifying ourselves with the material circumstance. Just like if I had a dream last night that I was a billionaire and everyone was worshipping me and, you know, doing all kinds of service to me. So I'd be very proud that here I am, I'm in this dream, and I have my dream house and dream wife and dream car and I have all my dream money and this is a great dream. And when the alarm goes off, I wake up, then I become very disturbed. That you stupid alarm clock, you ruined my life. But the life is just a dream. So similarly, this life, the only difference between this life and our night life, night dream, is that this dream of material existence simply lasts a little bit longer. Otherwise, there's really no big difference. And just as our previous lives, when we think about them now, they appear just like dreams. So our future, in the future, when we remember this life, it also appears to be just like a dream. But because we're attached to the false prestige of this dream, whatever we think that we're above someone else, this is called nirmana, moha, and this false prestige is due to illusion. We come here briefly, think ourselves to be this body, or the mind, or our conception of life, and go away, and still we're thinking we're the laws of everything that is here. Pita Sangha Dosha, and on that basis we form so much association. We think ourselves to be Americans or Russians or whatever. Even the animals don't think like that. For instance, if a bird flies here from Switzerland is not part of the EU, the European Union, then the Belgian birds at the border don't check it. Where's your passport? You remember? No, we're from Switzerland. Oh, sorry, go back. Swiss birds aren't allowed. Even the birds don't have that conception of life. You know, there's only so many trees for us birds here. That you Swiss birds, you got enough trees there. Just stay in your branch. Don't come here. But still, due to this identification, we imagine ourselves to be belonging to a certain country, and we form so many associations that I'm part of the Lions Club or the Elks Club or the whatever club we think we're belonging to. And then, Jita Sangha Dosha Adhyatma Nitya, one has to understand the difference between the body and oneself. So this has to be done if we want to make any progress. Not only do we have to give up our false prestige, our illusions based upon that false prestige, we have to give up our faulty associations. Doesn't mean we have to leave our family or our country, but we should stop identifying ourselves as that's who I really am. I may be in a Rolls Royce, I may be in a Volkswagen, but no intelligent person thinks that I've become a Volkswagen just because that's where I am in. So because we're in this country, it doesn't mean, or we're in this body, it doesn't mean that that's who we've become. But not that I've become someone else. I'm in a different body. Now I've understood that I'm the driver, that means I'm no longer in a Volkswagen, that means I'm in a Rolls Royce. Just because I've understood the difference between myself and a car. And we should understand that Adhyatma Nitya Vinavritta Kama. Then, as much as we've understood that, we should try to do something which is spiritually productive and not become overwhelmed by the dictation of our body and mind. It's true that we should live to eat, or we should eat to live, but it's not true that we should live to eat. In order to maintain the car, we have to put in gasoline, we have to put in oil, we have to nicely maintain it, but that shouldn't be one's whole life. Day and night, cleaning the car, putting in the gasoline, checking it every 5 minutes. We should maintain the car nicely, but we shouldn't simply live for the maintenance of the car. The car has a purpose, similar human form of life has a purpose. Adhyatma Nitya Vinivritta Kama is one vibrant mukha we should tolerate. Sometimes there may be some inconveniences. And then, Gacchanti Buddha Padam Avyam Tat, one should make one's goal to realize oneself and go back to one's original place called the spiritual world. And that's possible by proper knowledge and detachment, which Krishna explains later on, or he's explained. So that's a little bit of a summary. So what is the conclusion is that as far as reincarnation goes, if we understand that we're not the body, the next thing is we have to find out why we're in a body, what kind of body we enjoy, what kind of body we'll get in the next lifetime according to our present activities, and what we can do to get the best possible body, the next possible situation. And in the Bhagavad Gita recommends that we should engage in something called devotional service. That the owner of everything, the controller of everything, we should utilize our present energies according to how he recommends. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is recommending to us to utilize our energies according to his direction, not because he wants something, he has to gain something here. It is not that God, he has big palaces in the spiritual world, and he needs a lot of servants there. After all, if you're God with these big Chintamani palaces, then you need a lot of help. And it's hard to get good help. Therefore, he's coming here in this mature world, canvas, trying to convince people that come join me in the spiritual world, and you can clean my palace and you'll get a lot more pay than you get here. And I'll give you extra vacations and the food's good. And so he's trying to convince us to go back to that spiritual world to keep his palaces clean. He just needs a little good help, that's all. So Krishna's coming here because he knows it's only within our interest that we become spiritually realized. We begin our real life with complete happiness and full knowledge in relation to him. He'll be happy to see us happy. Just as our happiness means his happiness, as we perceive his happiness, then we become happy, and he becomes happy by seeing our happiness. Therefore, Krishna is coming simply for our happiness, and his direction is simply for our and others' benefit. That's called devotional service. So if we study this literature, try to understand it, try to understand who we are in relation to Krishna, performing activities which are conducive towards our spiritual advancement and revelation, then the result is that we can see practically for ourselves whether or not we're becoming aware of ourselves as spirit souls apart from every body that we've enjoyed or suffered in. So that even if we do have to take another body, we won't become bewildered by that body. We won't have to start all over again. That even in the next lifetime, one will begin where one is left off in this lifetime. So I'll stop here. Any questions? What about the happiness? Are you the happiness? No, of course we feel because we have consciousness. But what we're conscious of is the body. Just like we're experiencing so many things that we don't identify ourselves with. We may smell something, and it may not be a very nice smell. But that doesn't mean we become what we smell. Just like you can go to the zoo and smell a bear. You know, this bear doesn't smell very good. Needs a bath. But it doesn't mean we become a bear. Just because we smell the bear. Isn't that right? So because you're feeling the pain of the body, what does it mean that you become the body? It means that the body is in pain. And you're thinking, well, now I'm experiencing it, so you're empathizing with the body. Poor body, you're in pain. But that means that we're the ones who are experiencing it. The body's not the arm's hurting, and you're experiencing the pain of the arm hurting. The arm doesn't say, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm hurting. Is that right? The arm's not conscious. It's not lamenting, oh, I'm sorry I'm hurting you, I wish I was, you know, I wish I could do better for you, but that's the best I can do for you right now. Well, the arm's unconscious, but we're conscious of the unconscious arm. Yes? Yeah, there we have some degree of control. Because we're the passenger in the car, and Krishna's the driver. And Krishna, he says that he's neutral. Therefore, for instance, even now we have some degree of control. But it's not absolute control. For instance, if I want to fly in this room right now, I find it hard. Because I would, I don't know anyone else here. Probably it's universal here. We could flap our arms better. But most of us don't have, all of us, we don't have the ability to fly with this present body. But if I want to do something like, for instance, play the harmonium, then I can learn how to play it, because that's within the realm of my control, at least within the realm of my past activities, possibilities, if I want to do it. But not everyone would want to do it. Therefore, we do have some degree of control. And the symptom of that, how much control we have right now, depends upon what we've done in the past. What we've done in the past has determined what our present situation is, our present body. And according to that present body, we may have certain propensities, we may have certain abilities, we may have certain possibilities. But it's not all possible. It's not that everyone has the same possibilities, everyone has the same propensities, everyone has the same inclinations, everyone has different ones, qualifications. So someone may want to very strongly come back in their family, in the same family that they were born in previously. And Krishna notes that, and he sees according to their possibilities, according to their what they deserve, what they desire, then why not? It's not that it's a great thing, you know, that, wow, you know, the previous lifetime, I was grandmother. So why couldn't I become a grandchild? Someone has to do it. Why not me? Someone has to take that position. So Krishna says, all right, you want to do it? You got the first choice. Because you're the only one who wants to do it. No one else wants to do it. Yes. How are we different?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we're not Hindus. There's no such thing as a Hindu. People may think they're Hindus, but that's the same thing as thinking I am, you know, Christian or I'm tree or this and that. Actually, we're spiritual souls. We may be in something we call a Hindu body, but the philosophy of Hinduism or Krishna consciousness, Bhagavad Gita, we think Hinduism, Bhagavad Gita is a Hindu book. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna never said he was a Hindu. Arjuna never said he was a Hindu. Bhagavad Gita is not Hindu philosophy, it's a universal philosophy. It's for everyone, for all time. Just like everyone, whether it's a Hindu or Buddhist or atheist or Christian, whatever they are, or cat or dog, they have a body that's changing. And everyone has a soul, everyone is a soul within the body that's not changing. So that philosophy is universal. Similarly, God is just like the sun. We can call the sun many different names. In English, it's called the sun. In French or Spanish, El Sol. In Swanson, in Polish. But it's the same sun. We're just giving it a different label. So God is the same. Whether we call him Krishna or Jehovah, Allah, Rama, they're all expansions of the same Supreme Person. So it's not that Christians have their God, and we have our God, and the atheists, they don't have any God. Now everyone has the same God, same person that's controlling this universe, who's within our heart. It's not that the Christians have a Christian God in their heart, and the Hindus have a Hindu God, and the atheists, they don't have any God. It doesn't work like that. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Grandharaj Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande.